from calling things gay or using the N-word in a rap song out loud, or, you know, saying the F-word to refer to somebody who's a homosexual. These were like commonplace stuff in the area that I grew up in.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Got an interesting guest to bring to you today, a fellow journalist who comes at things from a different perspective, but I came across his work. And I've talked about before on the show how I want to have people from all over, right? Left, center, nonpartisan people, non-political people, not just your standard conservatives and libertarians that I do admit I talk to a lot. So joining me today on the show is Isaac Saul, editor of Tangle News, which is readtangle.com. Isaac, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Brad. I'm glad to be here.
So I've been reading your newsletter for a while, which people can check out. It's readtangle.com. And we'll discuss that newsletter a little bit more later because I want to talk about the state of journalism, a fun topic, because I imagine we both have thoughts on that. But first, I wanted to talk about a piece you wrote that caught my eye. The headline, I don't open every newsletter from you or from anyone I subscribe to, right? Whether I click on it in the inbox is often a question of how sexy and enticing is the headline. You know, I've got my 10 Substack subscriptions. I don't read them all every time. And it was confessing my sins. So I was like, oh, where's this one going to go? But no, it turned so the piece you wrote, which is different from what you usually do, it was a personal story about how you made mistakes as a teenager and connecting it to the ongoing conversation about cancel culture. So before we dive into that, can you just tell the audience and listeners a little bit about yourself and where you come from?
Yeah, for sure. So I grew up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is a bellwether political county. It's a really big deal in presidential elections because it often goes the way of the election, the national election. So and it's especially important to winning Pennsylvania, which is obviously an important race in presidential elections. So I grew up in a predominantly white area, pretty middle class, standard American town, I think, but really politically divided and lots of class divide too. And so I basically wrote about my experience growing up in this area as a teenager and a lot of the language that I used to use publicly, even on Facebook and, you know, social media platforms when they were in their infancy 10 or 15 years ago, and contextualize it kind of as, you know, how I've grown since then, basically, from calling things gay or using the N-word in a rap song out loud, or, you know, saying the F-word to refer to somebody who's a homosexual. These were like commonplace stuff in the area that I grew up in. And this piece was basically me saying, like, look, this is who I was, and here's how I kind of grew out of it. And a lot of that story is about people being forgiving towards me and giving me an opportunity to grow. And so I sort of wrote about that in the context of why I feel like some of this moment is a little bit dangerous and precarious and the things that worry me right now.
Yeah, I mean, because I've seen this, we've all seen this play out in the national conversation, particularly people who are plugged into the ins and outs of journalism drama. I mean, there was a New York Times reporter recently pushed out, a longtime veteran, for people who don't know this story, pandemic, covered the pandemic, apparently was a very valuable reporter. And he got, there's a little bit of controversy, but he essentially got pushed out because students that he went on a trip with a few years ago complained that he used the N-word in reference to conversation about it, not as a derogatory slur. And maybe you could argue someone shouldn't do that. Maybe you could argue they should, and it's fine. But either way, that certainly shouldn't be a career-ending mistake. And we've also seen many instances where people get canceled for slurs or bad words they used on social media posts, and they lose their college admissions, or they get fired from their job, or their nomination gets rescinded. And it always bothers me every time because I think people don't understand. And I'm curious for your thoughts on this, but imagine if people who are 50 or 60 right now all had digital records of everything they said and did at age 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20. it would be way worse than any of this stuff. And yet these people are the CEOs and the politicians, and nobody's canceling them. So I guess, first off, I think it takes some guts to admit you used a lot of language that would get you in trouble today. I know I certainly did. I mean, I am gay, and I said that stuff all the time. That was just part of the language and the parlance. And it shouldn't have been in many ways. But I guess I would ask, though, wasn't that like true for everyone? I mean, in the high school I was in, people would say that stuff all the time. It seems like that's such a common thing, yet online we pretend like these words are so outrageous and never used, but that's just not reality.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'll tell you, some of the feedback I got from writing it was really insightful. And even talking to my fiance, who, you know, she went to a school and grew up in an area that was a lot more diverse than the area I grew up in. And her perception was like, you know, she's only 2 years younger than me, but she was like, when I was in high school, we didn't say any of that stuff. So like, it's jarring for me to know that you were like that. And, you know, I think like that is sort of proof that even more than a generational thing, it's about the environment that you're in. It's about the place that you live, the people who are around you. And for someone like me, like it took a while for me to have somebody who was wiser and older and more respectful, and who I also, you know, looked up to. It wasn't like a parent or authority figure to be like, you know, you sound like an idiot and you should stop talking like that. And I got a range of responses to what I wrote, some really critical, some from people who were like, I'm so glad that, you know, I didn't have Facebook or Twitter. You know, I'm 50 or 60 years old, sort of what you're saying, like, I would be, you know, ruined, basically. And I got some other really interesting responses from people who are like, look, you know, if you zoom out and look at this on the grand scheme of things, 99.9% of the people who ever use this language or whatever are not canceled. They're not, you know, taken to the woodshed for it. It's a very small percentage of people who are made an example of, which I think is sort of a fair counter argument. And my concern is not so much the ratio of people who use this language and are canceled for it. It's about the way it's sort of celebrated in the public discourse. That is what really concerns me. It's like, you know, like the story I used was the example of Mimi Groves, the high school student who was written about in the New York Times, who basically lost her college admission for a video she made when she was in ninth grade. And, you know, Mimi Groves is probably one of a million teenagers who use that language. And she's one of the only ones I know about who lost her college admissions for it. So in that sense, it's like, it's not incredibly common, but
doesn't that make it all the more unfair to her though?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a good argument that it's like, exactly that it's more unfair to her because 999,000 other people did this and they didn't face the same repercussions for it. I wish I'd thought to say that to the reader who made that point, but even more for me is just like, I don't care about that ratio. What I care about is that when this story came out, it was like, it was celebrated and cheered on. There was a legitimate mass of people who were like, good, she got what she deserved. And I don't think that is what she deserved. I think, you know, I don't want to speak generally because I think every example should be looked at on its own, but I think what really concerns me is that there doesn't feel like there's an opening right now for the next generation that's coming up behind me to redeem themselves. It's like there's a purity standard that is so strong that a lot of kids are just going to be ruined for stuff they did when they were, I think, too young to be held so accountable for that kind of language.
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts to piggyback because I think this is a really interesting conversation. One is that your point's definitely taken about it matters what your high school environment was, right? And it may very well be true that people from more diverse areas or more wealthy, liberal areas may have had a very different culture at their schools. But I would be willing to bet that even for African-American young people, a lot of them probably said something not about race, but about something else that really didn't age well. A lot of women probably didn't say anything sexist that won't age well, but maybe they said something about race that won't age well when they were 16 and dumb and responding to the horrible incentives of social media and hormone-filled brains, right? So I feel like everybody, let the person cancel somebody who honestly can say that if you comb through every ounce of their digital history for their entire life, you wouldn't find something that would sound really bad out of context years later. Let that person cast the first stone. But so I found a point that you also mentioned really interesting. This question of, well, how big a deal of it is it of it? How big a deal is this really, the phenomenon? Because it is just a few people here and there. And to me, it's not actually about Mimi Groves. What happens to her ultimately is of little consequence. I feel bad for her, but whatever. It's about the message in our culture. Are we a culture that has grace for people to grow and learn and redeem themselves? Or are we a vindictive culture that writes people off and permanently closes that door? Because I think that's what a lot of these cancel culture stories say, is it sends this overarching message that if you made mistakes, you're canceled. There's not, you can't apologize for them, move on and grow, in some of these cases at least. And that's not a good message to be sending out in the culture, because if anything, that removes the incentive for people to stop using this language, to grow and to make the transition. And it will leave more people actually not making the evolutions on these things in the right direction. At least that's my concern.
And I think on top of that too, I'll just say, I also think that it radicalizes people. And this is sort of like, I alluded to it in the piece that I wrote, and I didn't really dig in too much on it because it was a little bit of an auxiliary point to what I was trying to say. But, you know, I look back at who I was as a 17 or 18 year old. And I think if I had gotten dogpiled on Twitter, or if I had been written about in the New York Times for something I did when I was 14, my reaction would have been rage. Like I would have been like, this is so unfair, screw all you guys. And I would have hated everyone who had sort of tried to like quote unquote ruin my life or whatever it was for this thing I did when I was a kid, basically. And I think if that had happened to me, I don't think it would have made me feel empathy for the other side or for the people who I might have hurt with my language or whatever. I think it would have made me hate them for like giving me a punishment that I felt like was unfair. And it probably would have pushed me more to the fringe, you know? And I think that's happening right now. I mean, I write about this when it comes to deplatforming and things like this, where it's like, you know, of course there are people like Alex Jones or something like that who I think it can be dangerous, and I don't want on certain platforms spewing his stuff or doxing people or whatever. Like, there have to be lines drawn. But I also think removing someone like him from a Twitter or Facebook or whatever, you know, we did that 4 or 5 years ago. And what happened at the January 6th Capitol riots? Like, Alex Jones was there with a megaphone talking to a bunch of his supporters, because for the last 5 years, they've all been listening to him. They've all been interacting with his content. They just haven't been doing it in the places where we see it or can refute it or can fight it. And like, that is really what concerns me, is that, you know, we isolate and push away people in a way that actually creates more radicals and more fringe people. And the more we do it now, it might make the spaces we operate in feel better, but I don't think it's a long-term solution to sort of like bringing the country together or some kind of cohesion, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think part of the problem is you want to have enough of a cultural negativity or backlash towards racial slurs and these sorts of things that people stop doing them, right? You don't want it to be laissez-faire on these things, but then it can't be to the point where retrospectively, if you use them in the past, it doesn't matter that you've apologized. It doesn't matter that you don't use them anymore. Like, that's the problem, because obviously we need some degree of not cancel culture, but of consequences for the things you say. No one really denies that. And that's the thing about cancel culture, is we all do agree that there's some limits and some guardrails to polite society. I think the most important distinction is really going to be, do we allow for grace? Do we allow for redemption in these conversations and in these examples? And I think if you don't, then people say, well, why should I even bother? Why should I even try to not offend people with my language? And honestly, I think that's how you start getting young, disenfranchised white men all of a sudden looking at alt-right forums and people that don't care at all about this PC left. And they still have their own moral culpability in that if they go down that path. Don't get me wrong. I'm all about personal responsibility. But you can only do this. We've seen this with, in my opinion, Democrats and liberal media. They spent so long calling everyone racist that somebody like Trump comes around who actually does say racist things, and their accusations and their criticisms don't have weight anymore because they call everyone that disagrees with them a racist. They called Mitt Romney a racist in 2012. Joe Biden said he would put black people back in chains if he was elected. And so these things, this whole culture of overcorrection seems to me to be backfiring, and like it could backfire much worse.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like there are ramifications coming for some of the deplatforming and the censoring and stuff like that that we just don't see right now. I think, you know, especially as it relates to like QAnon and these kinds of groups that have been taken out off Facebook or Twitter, or other places, I see a lot of rhetoric and conversations and stories in the media world like, look, it worked. We're 2 months into this. Look at how, you know, how effective it was. When was the last time you saw this thing in your feed? And
that doesn't mean it's not there.
Right. It doesn't mean it's not there. Like, we've also seen a huge surge in the use of Telegram and Clubhouse and all these other places where people are having conversations that are outside the purview of, you know, the public sphere that they were happening in beforehand. And, you know, I also said in the piece, and I think it's worth saying now, that I think this needs to happen on both sides too. You know, we're going to talk about it, I think, a little bit, but my newsletter is very much about presenting arguments from the right and the left. And there are a lot of readers who have written into me from the left who make very valid arguments about the cancel culture that exists on the right in conservative circles, whether it's like, you know, you say a bad word about the military, you kneel for the national anthem. Donald Trump, obviously the leader of the party, basically tried to take down any news network that was critical of him. I mean, it exists on both sides, I think, to a different degree. And for some people who are minorities, and, you know, you talk about being a gay man, like, I think there are people who say, look, I've been canceled by my church. I've been canceled by the military. I've been canceled by the Republican Party, who doesn't care about what Black people think or whatever, you know? And it's just a simple, difficult, horrible fact we have to deal with, that there's like a lot of vindictiveness on both sides right now. But also, you know, it's not a phenomenon that's unique to the left. I think certainly the cultural sensitivity on the left is stronger, especially about language. But, it's happening everywhere in politics. People just sort of flex it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw today news about a bunch of Tennessee Republican state senators who are trying to make it so that any athlete in the college system in Tennessee who kneels during the national anthem is punished. So yeah. These are elected officials, the government, trying to shut down speech they don't like because it offends their sense of patriotic correctness. So I'm certainly happy to point out, and I know I'm not the typical kind of conservative in this, but I'm happy to point out that Republicans do this stuff too. I've actually written about something that mortifies me. I tend to agree with right-wing arguments on most, if not all, religious liberty matters, but there's polling that shows a huge chunk, and I don't have the exact numbers around me, but a huge chunk of Republican voters say they'd be okay with laws blocking the construction of new mosques. And wow. I'm like, if that is not right-wing, PC, illiberal, anti-free speech, cancel culture on steroids, I don't know what is. So I'm happy to say that there's both sides are a problem. Though I will say, I generally think in terms of language and offensiveness and calling people names, labeling them bigot, racist, homophobe, hateful, the left is worse, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a different priority, but I agree. I think it's certainly more common on the left. And it's like, you know, it's cyclical. I mean, this is the thing that's really difficult about breaking the cycle, is that you talk about that stat. I haven't heard that statistic before, but even if you assume it's a big chunk of it, you know, that feeds into the belief and the narrative on the left that language that, you know, conservatives are using is indicative of something a lot more insidious. And, you know, in some cases, clearly, and might be if a bunch of Republicans would vote to support shutting down MAS or refusing to build more MAS. And so it's like the assumption of the worst. It, you know, that means anytime anybody who's a conservative uses language that sounds a little bit off to the ear about a Muslim person, whatever, and maybe they're saying something out of ignorance, then the assumption on the left is like, oh, this person is an Islamophobe, they're a bigot, whatever, and we should bring them down, basically. And it's that kind of like mob mentality, and it feeds back and forth. And I said in the piece, I don't have a perfect solution. I don't know exactly what the answer is. What I do know is how I was reformed and how my perspective and my worldviews changed. And it took a little while, and it took people giving me some space to be an idiot and be offensive and be hurtful, and also like patiently explain to me, because I was 16 or 17 or whatever, that, you know, these things mattered and my words had an impact, and this is why I shouldn't speak like that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So a little bit about me that you probably don't know. I've talked about it on the podcast a few times, but I went to one of the farthest left colleges you could find in America. UMass Amherst has the distinction of having the only Marxist economics department. And economics is my main beat, and I was an economics major, so that's where I studied. The professors, this isn't me saying like a slur, like they would call themselves Marxists. And so the campus is very much like a far left social justice bubble, where about 20% of the student body is radical left wing activists. And the rest is indifferent center left people who just let them do all the talking and handle all the politics things on campus. And so it really pushed me to the opposite extreme, really. And I, over time, broadened my horizons and became kind of less reactionary right wing, Charlie Kirk-y, trigger the libs-y. Because I realized that, you know, nothing in life is black and white. And at the same time that I think safe spaces and free speech zones are stupid, there's also are some things maybe you shouldn't say about a certain group or languages, or there are some real issues that have to do with race in America, even if it's not the kind of dystopia described by the social justice left on college campuses. So I came to that middle ground over time. Well, not really middle ground, but different ground, more nuanced ground. But I mostly did it not by being scolded, which I was scolded plenty. Trust me, that only has the opposite effect. It reinforces your beliefs. I mostly in reality did it by meeting people with different experiences and befriending people with different experiences than my own and different backgrounds, not by being told I was ignorant or stupid or bigot or wrong.
Yeah. And I think that's a huge part of it. It's like, you know, you look at a lot of the polls about sentiments some Americans have towards other Americans, whether it's, you know, how someone feels about a Muslim person, for example. It's another great example. There's been a lot of really interesting social studies about, you know, the people who feel the most antagonistic towards Muslim people are also the people who know the fewest Muslim people.
That's like, true for gay people too, especially how people feel about gay people. It's like, if a lot of times really Christian, really conservative people polled or Muslim people will have really harsh views on gay issues at higher percentages if they don't know a gay person in real life.
Right. And that experience is totally borne out in my own life too. You know, I mean, I don't think I ever really had any antagonism towards any particular group of people growing up. I mean, I grew up in a pretty open, loving home, but I think what I did do as I grew up was I got a lot better understanding about the experiences people were having and why certain things mattered to certain groups. And, you know, if I was coming from a place where I had really strong biases or really strong antagonistic feelings about certain groups of people, meeting them and hearing from them would have changed that, I think. And, you know, it's why this kind of like redemptive work, in my opinion, is so important. And it's why we need it so much in the political discourse.
Well, so let's talk about this from a slightly different angle, which will transition us to kind of the journalism aspect of things, which I know we want to talk about too and discuss your project. But a big malicious actor, and this is my view speaking, in these cancel culture things is journalists, left-wing and liberal social justice-oriented journalists at the New York Times or the Washington Post, who write these cancel culture hit jobs and really take this extremely unforgiving and uncharitable view towards taking total strangers who aren't involved in politics and humiliating them and getting and writing stories about them in the name of like social justice or accountability. And I guess to what extent is that a nature of the fact that, setting aside conservative media, which is its own ecosystem and bubble, mainstream media is overwhelmingly left-wing or left-leaning. And most journalists at the mainstream outlets are liberals and have or don't donate to Democrats. These things are all borne out by polls and donor information and a cursory read of their content. To what extent do you agree with that assessment and think that that plays into it, in that the same way people have, you know, ignorant views of gay people when they don't know any gay people, it's easy to malign people unfairly or have a really skewed perspective in your newsroom, when it feels to me like a lot of these newsrooms have all sorts of diversity at the skin deep level, the surface level, but not a whole lot of ideological diversity going on at all?
Yeah, so I guess I have two responses to that. One sort of related to the mainstream media description, or I guess like the overview of it. I've written about this before. I actually don't really subscribe to the idea that the quote unquote mainstream media has a liberal bias, because I don't subscribe to the idea that the New York Times or the Washington Post represent the mainstream media anymore. I mean, I think that argument might have been true 20 years ago, but if you just look at the landscape now of how people consume their news, I mean, the most watched show on television is Fox News, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, two of the most circulated newspapers in the world. The top posts on Facebook every day are from conservatives, the top talk radio, the top podcasts. I mean, in the post Rush Limbaugh era, I think there's actually a pretty healthy balance of right-leaning and left-leaning news outlets out there. And I struggle to talk about the media world as like a monolith. So I find myself like cringing a little bit when I hear people sort of try and label the whole media ecosystem as left-leaning, because, you know, I don't know that the New York Times has as much power as Fox News anymore. In fact, I think they probably don't.
Well, so let me ask you about this, right? Because the New York Times, and this is a fact I just saw, has more digital subscribers than the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and all 50 Gannett newspapers combined. Right. I do think that it's fair to identify a mainstream media that consists of, and I acknowledge, right, it's not just liberal media. There's plenty of conservative media, right? But all the mainstream outlets, to me, I've done this, right, in terms of, if you look at the 50 biggest newspapers in America, 47 of them have a liberal leaning editorial page and bias, right? I mean, the only ones that don't are the Wall Street Journal, the Las Vegas newspaper, I forget the name of it, a couple in Texas, one in Florida. Like, there's a very small number of newspapers. And then all the cable stations except for Fox and Fox News and Fox Business, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, CNN. It does seem to me that there's this big institutional mainstream media that is becoming much less important. YouTube, podcasts, this whole alternative new media is becoming much more mainstream and much more important. But that old mainstream media, to me, still has a liberal bias.
Yeah, I think when I think about the New York Times, like that stat about the subscribers, to me, that's more indicative of like a wealthy liberal class that is paying for premium news content in the era of Trump, because like nobody on the left could stop reading anything about Donald Trump. I mean, it was like an obsession for 4 years. And I actually think it's a problem, because I think it's sort of produced this division where a lot of the news that's free is like fundamentally different content than a lot of the news that you have to pay for in like the media ecosystem. It's a totally fair point about the other news outlets out there. I mean, I definitely don't think NBC or ABC have a right-leaning bias. I think a lot of progressives would watch ABC or NBC or 60 Minutes, and they would see like a center, maybe center left corporate news landscape that they also detest in the same way a lot of the people on like the populist right do. To me, like MSNBC and CNN are pretty decidedly left now. I have to say, I do not watch cable news. It's like I've sworn off
it. Me neither, bro. Yeah, young people do not watch cable news. I only watch it when I'm on it.
Yeah, it's like it's I think it's worms for your brain at this point. And I tell people, it's like, you know, like I have a fundamental belief that you shouldn't watch your news. You should read it. You should listen to it. But if you're watching it, you're probably being fed something that's supposed to be entertainment, which I don't think is what journalism is.
Well, let me ask about that, about journalism, because do you think, to some extent, I have conflicted feelings about this. I am an opinion journalist. I write op-eds labeled opinion, right? So I'm very clear that I'm not a neutral journalist. Obviously, we've seen media become less neutral. I think that's fair to say. But is that because, I'm curious for your take, some people think objectivity itself is kind of a myth and not really a noble goal. I'm somewhat sympathetic to that in the sense of everyone should be upfront about their biases, and that more things that are labeled analysis should be labeled opinion. And Fox News, in my opinion, should have a different logo when an opinion host is on the show that says Fox News commentary, right? Yeah. Rather than Fox News, because it's most people don't understand media literacy is very low.
Right.
And so my view is, I kind of think the genie's out of the bottle in terms of unbiased, neutral media, and that the solution is more honesty and transparency about bias. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so my perspective is like, I think A, people, like you said, they don't really have a great grasp, the average American, of the separation of powers between the editorial page and the news division or the news desk. I mean, you look at the Wall Street Journal. Every day these days, the Wall Street Journal opinion page is publishing something that is like directly in conflict with what the news team is saying. I mean, I was pointing this out about some of the Texas reporting, that it's like they're like two separate sets of facts that they're working from, which to me is a big issue. I absolutely will grant you that the New York Times and the Washington Post obviously have very left-leaning editorial pages. You know, I'll also point out that the New York Times is the newspaper that broke the Hillary Clinton email story that basically ended her political career. I mean, every day, I think the New York Times and the Washington Post investigative journalist teams do really strong reporting that is very damaging to a lot of liberal or Democratic figures. The issue, in my opinion, is not so much that those stories exist or don't exist. I mean, I think you can make a good argument, and I'm sure there are some studies about this, that like the story selection probably has a liberal bias even on the news desk, but it's that the readers of those papers are liberals. And so their feet, it's like this cycle where they click on the story the most, so it ends up on the homepage, it ends up being shared the most. So the stories you always see every day on Twitter or Facebook or whatever from the Washington Post and New York Times are stories that are really damaging for Republicans, because they're being shared the most by the liberal writers. And if you're a writer at the Washington Post and you're being measured by something like how many page views your stories get, now there's like a broken incentive structure. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a cyclical thing where, you know, for my newsletter, I go very deep on the Washington Post and New York Times news pages every day. And I find stories there that are really damaging for Democrats or liberals or whatever, or undermine a certain liberal narrative. It's just like, they're not on the front page. They're not being plastered across the front page because they're not being clicked on and shared a lot.
This interests me because I see what you're saying. I mean, the New York Times opinion section drives their main traffic, but their reporting, in my view, is a lot better than their opinion section. I think their opinion section these days is pretty poor. Not a lot of interesting or nuanced thought going on there, in my view. But it's usually like trending as the Charles Blow hot take about why every Trump supporter is a white nationalist. And then you see the investigative national security reporter's 2000 word piece on the Afghanistan document scandal, right? No one reads. Right. So I totally acknowledge that. I think though, the news pages I read, I'm like you, I read every day, I read CNBC, Fox Business, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, news pages every day. And I'm often reading business and economic stories. And so I do have a little bit of a skewed focus there. But what I notice is not bias in the news reporting in terms of conscious bias. What I notice is selection bias. Hmm. Which studies do they cover? Which experts do they ask for their opinion? What assumptions, especially in economic news, oftentimes progressive assumptions about the economy are just assumed into the way economic news is reported when these are actually hot matters of dispute among economists. And so that's a bias I really do detect in the news. And I also think the news industry does itself a disservice because it seems to me every day, even outlets I've worked at, have a few total hacks on staff that constantly command attention and hurt the reputation and distract from the work that a bunch of good other people are doing.
I agree with everything you just said, almost to the letter. I mean, this is literally why I started the newsletter that I started. And to sort of get to another question you asked before about objectivity, I mean, I am really sympathetic to like the Wes Lowry framing of objectivity in journalism, which is that like nobody is truly objective. We all have biases. I think my pushback on it, and maybe it's even not pushback on how he views it, because I think he probably views it this way too, is like there are fair ways to tell a story and there are unfair ways to tell a story. And it's a really hard thing to define. For me, it's like, I know it when I see it, especially if I'm reading about something where I like understand the topic really well. But I mean, I started Tangle precisely for this reason, because I have my own personal experiences and I have my own biases. And I wanted to sort of transcend that by saying like, here's work and here are opinions that are different than mine. Here are views from the left, here are views from the right. Here's like the basic story we're working from. And then here's what I think. And every day I'm publishing, you know, reader feedback from people who are criticizing the things I write. And I really believe this is
like, I love that.
But yeah, it's one of the only ways, in my opinion, that you can actually approach something now in today's political discourse that is like a holistic truth, because you have to pull from different sources. Like you said, I mean, this is the thing. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have the best journalists, the best, most experienced, most expert reporters on any given topic in the world, because they pay the best. And if they want somebody on their staff, they offer them the most money and they come work for them. And two of those reporters, one from the Wall Street Journal and one from the New York Times, can cover the exact same event, and the story will look dramatically different, even on the news desk. And that's it right there. I mean, that's like the whole ball game, in my opinion, is like, neither of those reporters are bad people. They're not lying to you. They're not trying to obscure the truth. They just come to it with their own sources, with their own experience, with their own fundamental beliefs in how to shape the story. And what they come out with is like two separate things. And so if you want the actual quote unquote truth, or you want an actual full perspective, you actually just have to read both articles. Like, that's the solution. There isn't like some clean middle ground. You just have to read both, or you're never going to get the opinion from the scholar who is like a little bit more conservative, like you might find in the Wall Street Journal.
Right. It's even what think tanks do they get quotes from? What politicians' offices do they get a quote from? Like, you might read the Wall Street Journal story and it quotes a Republican and a Democrat, and the New York Times story quotes a Republican and a Democrat, but the Democrat is Elizabeth Warren and the Republican is Susan Collins in the New York Times story. And in the Wall Street Journal story, it is Kristen Sinema and Ted Cruz, right? And it's like, those, in both cases, they followed a fair, accurate presentation, but it's different, right? And I agree with what I liked about Tangle, because I came across your newsletter when you, I think, cited me in it. And then I subscribed and I read it, not everyone, but a lot of them. I like the format of, here's what the left's saying, here's what the right's saying, here's what I think, because then I can go to the links and actually read fully. And what I often try to do is, in opinion, I think bad opinion journalism has two common threads, and I can look back at things I have written and seen them. Ad hominem, even when it's true, even when I think AOC is dumb, right? Me calling her a dumb socialist in a FoxNews.com op-ed only distracts from the quality of my own argument, right? Rather than saying Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. Similarly, right, saying that Trump's immigration policy is wrong because he's a racist and his supporters hate immigrants, rather than explaining the facts or the arguments or the policy, is not good opinion journalism. And also, it's like, I make a conscious effort to state the other side's view that I'm arguing against, not in a straw man manner. And what I tend to do now is quote them directly, rather, because I think if I try to paraphrase their view, I probably won't do it justice. So when I write about a new bill AOC said or a thread she wrote, I embed the whole thing, or I quote two paragraphs from her press release and link to it. So it's like, at least then I'm presenting her view accurately enough because it's from her mouth. It's not my distortion of her view. I hate when I read liberal things that or liberal columns that respond to a conservative argument. And it's like, they're not even really responding to the argument. They're responding to this kind of like dumbed down straw man version of it, and vice versa, right? Like, the left's abortion position is that killing babies is good.
Right.
Obviously not, right? That's obviously not what liberal people believe. But so I guess this kind of, here's the depressing part, and this is the question I have for you. Is there really that much of a demand for the nuanced journalism? Because I've always found the incentives run the other direction. And I've had to kind of build my career going against a stream that really is pushing in the way of hyper-partisan and inflammatory content. What's it been like for you since you started Tangle? Is there demand for nuanced stuff that doesn't engage in all that behavior?
I'll say totally honestly that I really truly believe there is. I mean, I get emails every day from people who are like, I've been looking for this my whole life. Like, where have you been? Where has this been? This has always been the kind of news that I wanted. And not just people who are moderates, like center left, center right, but
I'm
also,
not moderate.
Right. But also people who are like far right, far left, strong progressives, strong conservatives, who are like, you know, straight ticket Democratic Republican voters, because they're like, I want to know what the other side's saying. And I know I'm not getting that when I read the New York Times, or I know I'm not getting that when I watch Fox News. And they like conceptually really understand that. So they're compelled by the idea of like, let me hear this argument. And sort of to your point, the other thing that I hear all the time is people saying, oh, wow, I didn't know, like, that's a pretty good argument from conservatives about why we should limit immigration. Like, I've never heard that argument before, because if they're watching MSNBC or whatever, the only thing they're getting is the worst, most inflammatory argument that's taking up all the oxygen in the room. And like, you know, this is why someone like Charlie Kirk, in my opinion, who is clearly very good at rallying, you know, young conservatives to a cause, or maybe getting them
mostly
out to
boomers,
vote. Right? Yeah, apparently, based on like his Facebook traffic and all that. But even if you take how he describes his work at face value, which I agree is probably not a very strong description of it, you know, he's doing more to alienate and to excite the Democratic base and left-wing readers than anything else. Like, a lot of the liberals and the moderates who are reading my newsletter, if they weren't getting the constant stream of Charlie Kirk and Trump and Tucker Carlson,
Don Jr.
Right. And Don Jr. in their inbox and on the homepage of the New York Times and whatever, they would be literally less motivated to vote the way that they vote, because they're finding compelling arguments. And I am trying to elevate arguments. You know, the bias selection that I have is like, on both sides, I'm looking for arguments that I believe are strong, convincing arguments that are doing battle with each other on whatever the big issue of the day is. And that's not always easy, because it's like, you know, Charlie Kirk, Tucker Carlson. I mean, Tucker admittedly actually does some really great stuff, so I shouldn't maybe lump him in. I think he's a little bit more intellectual than Charlie Kirk is. But, you know, do I really find his arguments convincing? No, but a lot of people do. So should I include them? I'm not really sure some days, like, do I want to represent what the right's thinking, or do I want to represent what I think the best argument is on the right? And that's a really big challenge. And it happens on the left too, because, you know, every other Twitter personality on the left is some guy who's like a former actor who's now a political activist or whatever. And a lot of those opinions are complete trash. And the whole game is that everybody on the right is evil and racist and xenophobic and whatever. And I know that's representative of some of the views, but since I don't find that a particularly compelling argument about how to handle, you know, minimum wage increase or whatever, then I'm not going to include it. So it's a tough challenge, but I mean, my newsletter has 20,000 subscribers. It's grown. It's read in 35 countries outside the US. It's read in every state in America.
How can people sign up?
ReadTangle.com is the best place to find it. ReadTangle, TANGLE.com. If you just search Tangle Politics, you'll find it. I really do fundamentally think that America wants this. I think people are getting exhausted by being enraged. And there's a lot more people who are near the middle out there than you would think from watching the evening news or the primetime lineup.
Well, I think that is a good place to leave this serious conversation. And I do encourage people to check out your newsletter. And I will put the link in the show notes for anybody that just wants to click on it. But now, for the most coveted part of the episode, Isaac, hit us with your controversial food take.
All right. My controversial food take is that I believe feta cheese is the best cheese.
Okay. On what? What do you eat it on?
I have recently been putting feta cheese on pretty much everything. I put it on salads. I put it on certain meat dishes. It can like boost your rice, your quinoa. It can go on some broccoli. I'm putting it in scrambled eggs. The other day I made a quesadilla with cheddar cheese, and then I just put in some feta cheese too, and it made it significantly better.
See, I like feta, I like cheddar, but I also like American cheese.
Yeah.
Because I believe in America.
Yeah, America. American cheese is terrible. That's a horrible food take on your part.
That's one of my horrible food takes.
I appreciate you being honest about it.
All right, everybody. That's it for today. Go ahead and check out Isaac's newsletter at readtangle.com, and we'll talk to you all again next week. Thank you.